SQPN.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale by Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Hello and welcome back to The Secrets of the Hobbit, the show where we talk about the upcoming two movies based on J.R.R. Tolkien's book, The Hobbit. It's currently in production in New Zealand. We analyze all the latest news, we let you know everything that's happening over there, and we dive into the actual story itself and the inspiration that is, of course, the basis for the movies, but also we look at the genesis of the story itself, of The Hobbit and the backstory and the history and the languages and all the other elements that J.R.R. Tolkien developed over the years to flesh out the story of The Hobbit and the story of Middle-earth. And just as always, we have Dave Kale with us today on Skype to fill us in on what's happening over there in New Zealand. Not that you live in New Zealand, but you live not that far away, like in California. So that's, what, 3 hours by plane?
Right. Just right across the Pacific Ocean, no big deal.
Right. Well, it's definitely...
Good morning, Father.
Good morning. It's definitely closer to you than it is to me. For me, it's literally the other side of the world, the other side of the planet. But... thank goodness for the internet through which we can stay up to date on the latest news literally 24 hours a day, because when we are sleeping, the people in New Zealand are working and are updating and are posting news. And today, even a huge surprise, this morning we had our first video from the set of The Hobbit. Posted on Peter Jackson's Facebook page. And of course, that will be a very important ingredient of this show. We will kind of go through everything that was in that video bit by bit, try to analyze it, try to give you enough reason to go rewatch that frame by frame as we did. But before we go to the main course, let's start with a few appetizers, the smaller news. So what's been happening, Dave, this past week?
Well, actually, let's bookend it with Peter Jackson news. So we'll finish with the big thing, the video. But I'll start with he also posted some pictures, and one of them in particular was pretty cool. And this, I mean, you see this also in the video, but it shows them filming some scenes from what people think is probably the Riddles in the Dark section of the movie. So that's you know, spoiler alert if you haven't read the book, guys. This is the section of the book when Bilbo gets lost in the mountains, in the bowels of the mountains, and first meets Gollum. And they have a riddle contest. So anyway, if you go over to Peter Jackson's Facebook page, you'll be able to see this picture. And it's pretty cool. So what you see is Peter Jackson standing next to the screens that are displaying what the 3D camera is filming, which is pretty awesome. But if you look closely at the screens, you'll see what looks like
it's kind of a
Bilbo
cave
down in the cave.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a dark set. It's not that interesting if you don't know what's going on. But once you realize that, wow, this is a pivotal scene in the story. This is so important because this is the moment that, Bilbo and Gollum meet for the first time. That the ring comes into play, and that, of course, is the thing that sets in motion everything else later on in this third age of Middle Earth. And there would be no Lord of the Rings trilogy without this particular event happening. So very, very cool. You can also see that in the background there is a bit of green screen on that photo. So they will obviously use set extensions. They build part of the set, and then whatever is green screen is filled in later on with either artwork or digital creations of you know, the rest of the cave. I don't remember from the story itself. Was it a big cave, or is it more like a set of tunnels?
Yeah, I think it's sort of both. There's a set of, at least the way I always pictured it in my mind, is there's a set of tunnels leading down to kind of a chamber. But I do think that the main cave where he ends up, sort of at the bottom where Gollum hangs out and lives, is actually fairly large, because there's sort of an underground lake.
Yes.
Or pond.
We did see a glimpse of that particular area, of course, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, mm-hmm. where Gollum is sitting there on this rock, and I think he's trying to catch a fish or something, or he's talking to himself.
Yes.
about the precious, and it's a very short sequence, but it does give us an idea of what the complete room or cave will look like.
Do you think they reuse some of that set?
No, I don't think so. I gather from, and we'll talk about that later on when we analyze the first video from the set. I think that they must have thrown away a lot of the material from the set. Of course, because a lot of this is you know, created with very cheap material. It looks very real in the movies, but usually they use like plywood and plastic and whatnot, and so it's almost impossible to store all that material. What they will usually do is they will look at the existing footage and at the perhaps the designs that were made kind of in the planning phase of the Lord of the Rings, and they will just recreate that, just rebuild it, because they still know what it should look like, and that's probably much cheaper than storing everything. It's very unusual for bigger sets to be preserved like that. That only happens with huge franchises. But even in with a franchise like Star Trek, I was watching a documentary the other day about the archives of Star Trek, and they really had to go hunting for all that material, because at first, when the series was not yet, the huge thing it is right now culturally, they didn't really care. It was just a TV show, so they would just reuse a lot of the material for other scenes, sometimes even for other series. And and a lot of it was just taken away from the set by fans, or it just ended up, on eBay or wherever. And so now with Star Trek, and they did the same thing with Star Wars, they just went on this scavenger hunt to try to recover as many set pieces and props as possible. But it's almost impossible to find everything. And again, the sets for The Hobbit were huge. I mean, just look at the set for Bag End. I remember that there was a whole story about this, that they were about to throw away the set. And I think, I should look this up again, but I think Peter Jackson actually said, I will store it. Let me just keep it, because I might build my little hobbit hole later on in the future. but otherwise, it would have been thrown away as well. And even if they put it in storage, they want to pack that in as little space as possible, so set pieces get damaged. And at the time when they filmed The Lord of the Rings, they had no plans whatsoever to film The Hobbit. Even Peter Jackson was like, I'm not going back to Middle Earth. This is it. This is the end. And he really couldn't have known that right now he would be standing in those same sets again, or recreations of those sets, filming this kind of foundation for his trilogy. So
interesting.
Yeah, we see the monitors, which is cool also from a technical point of view, because we see that there are we see four monitors, two smaller ones and two bigger ones, both showing the individual images filmed by the two cameras, because of course this whole movie is filmed in 3D. They have two cameras for each shot, and so instead of kind of merging them together right there, they just have two monitors that are linked directly, probably to the two cameras, to the two digital cameras.
Very exciting.
That was the first photo. There was another photo also on the Facebook page, but that was just how do you call a thing like that? Like a it's like this white plastic board that they put in front of when they start filming. They write down what the scene is. Is that a clapper or something?
Yes, I should know that word. I live in Los Angeles, right? All that thing.
A slate or a...
I think slate. Oh, yeah. In the comments he put, our slate for the films showing 48 frames per second. So
it is actually a device that was used in the early days to synchronize audio and video because... the audio wasn't recorded in the same way as the video. Video was just on film, but there's no sound on film. There is no magnetic strip on the film itself, at least not in movie making. And so the sound would be recorded on regular tape with a totally different device. And in order to match the sound exactly, you know, to put it in sync, they would kind of clap this thing together. It would make a spike in the sound waves, and so later on they could very easily kind of put together the sound to the picture. Nowadays that's really not necessary anymore because all these devices, sound is still recorded separately, but all these devices are linked through computers and they use a universal time code, so they know exactly what they're filming. But still, this is still, I guess, a very standard way to begin a shot. It's kind of also for the whole archiving, because of course they will shoot a scene multiple times, and so you need to have a very elaborate system of archiving all that material for the editing phase later on, when you will go through all the material and you will decide, well, I'll take this fragment from this scene, and then we did like a fourth take on this counter shot, you know, over the shoulder shot, and we'll use that one. And so that is why every single bit has to be documented. It's a daytime job. Usually you have one person or several people on bigger productions that just monitor that, you know, what is recorded and what is the version, what is this the number of the scene. And it is even if they kind of lose track or if they make a mistake, then they will still have that visual indicator at the beginning of each sequence that will show them, well, okay, this is scene 5, you know, blah blah blah, and take 15, and that's kind of what you see in that second picture. Now this leads into actually a fairly big story. Also very newsworthy. This is still a very much technical discussion. We're not really talking about the story of The Hobbit right now, but I was blown away.
It's still big
news. It is. This was huge news, and it was the announcement with this photo that Peter Jackson is going to film The Hobbit in 48 frames per second. Now, you might think, so what? What's right? 48? What's, you know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, what is this whole frames per second? Well, as you know, film is basically a sequence of photos. The camera opens, it registers the light, it puts the light on celluloid. How do you pronounce that? So it's either a chemical process or it's a digital process. But basically the movement is created by showing you a sequence of still photos. It's mm-hmm. always been like that. And I don't know, when I was a kid, I used to make my own animated movies by, I had these books and I would just, you know, draw a little puppet on one page and I would just use the corner of the book, and then I would, you know, put another page on top of it. I would change the figure a little bit, and then thus I would draw all these different, you know, walking puppets or what. And if you just flipped with your finger through the pages, you could see animation. It was like
a flip book.
Exactly. It was like, and then my little puppet would move. So, but that was still in the time that I thought I had a huge career in front of me as an animator. Turned out differently. Anyway, but I just love that. To me, it was kind of magic. You draw individual still pictures, and then all of a sudden, you show them in very rapid sequence, and it moves, and it comes to life. That is the principle of a film. And for a long, long time, ever since the 1920s, the compromise was to show 24 frames, 24 still images per second. And this has to do, and Peter Jackson explains this in the article that he wrote on his Facebook page about this whole process. This was kind of the minimum amount of frames that still kind of made for a relatively smooth movement on the screen. Now, the reason that they reduce it to just 24 images per second is that the film itself, the material, was very expensive. And so the more you used, the more it cost, not only while filming, but also in reproducing the movie. And so 24 frames, it was the best frame rate at the time. Also, you know, when linked to the sound, it could still, the speed, because then, of course, once the movie is in theaters, then the sound track, the magnetic band or strip is placed on the same the same film roll. And so you can imagine that if you only, let's say you would only have 12 images per second, then not only would the movement be very kind of blocky and stuttering, but also the film would move much slower, which means much less quality audio wise. You know, the faster you can input information, the better the sound quality. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, this was all still pre-digital. And so for more than a century, well, now almost a century, the films have been made at 24 frames per second. And we are totally used to that. Even today, when people want to kind of simulate a film look, they will shoot in 24 frames per second because it's now part of kind of our visual culture. Where when we see something that is shot in 24 frames per second, you might not really realize that you're watching at that slow frame rate, but it tells your mind, this is a movie, this is a film, this is not TV, because TV and modern, let's say, video cameras, and the video cameras that you have yourself, or if you make any movies with the camera in your phone, for instance, usually the frame rate is much higher for digital video. And for most of the stuff that you see on TV, the frame rate is either 50 frames or 60 frames per second, and so that changes. The movement becomes much more fluent, of course, because instead of just seeing 24 still images, you see like double that. And if you've ever seen, for instance, like sitcoms that are filmed on video, it kind of almost looks too real. It doesn't give you this impression that you're watching a film, and it's because the movement is so kind of realistic that it sends a different signal to our brains, because we're so used to, you know, film is 24 frames per second and TV and video, that is, you know, 50 or 60 frames per second. And so they made the decision to switch from 24 frames per second to 48 frames per second. So it's double the visual information. They're already filming in HD, so that's already a lot of data that they need to crunch. But instead of doing it 24 frames per second, like with the first generation of digital professional movie cameras, they're now switching to double that. And there are a couple of reasons that Peter Jackson gives for that. But the most important one is that, according to him, it gives you a much better experience in 3D. So let's say that you move the camera, for instance, you pan the camera from left to right while filming, I don't know, a hobbit that is running away. If you only take 24 pictures in that, you know, in that 1 second that you move the camera, the lens of the camera is going to be open during the movement, so it creates a blur. Now, if you would take 48 pictures during that same second, those pictures, instead of having a long exposure time, will have a much shorter exposure time, and so the individual frames will be much sharper. Instead of having motion blur, everything will be super sharp, and that kind of creates an illusion of much more like a fluidity, sharpness. It's less, your brain doesn't need to fill in the rest of the movement. You know, you get much more data, so your brain can relax. And that is kind of the core reason that Peter Jackson mentions. They've been watching a lot of the dailies, which is usually the result after a day of filming. They will take all that material and they'll go through that. And that's why it's called dailies, because it's, you know, it's kind of a daily amount of filmed material that you have to screen and select. And you know, that's when they make the first decisions of, oh, we like this, or might even say on the basis of the dailies, we have to go back and reshoot this scene because we didn't see that, you know, that Hobbit was picking his nose. So that sort of stuff. So, but of course, since they are shooting this in 3D, they have to watch this with, you know, the glasses on, and because they have to verify everything in 3D. Now, if they were looking at these dailies, and we're talking about several hours of material every day, in 24 frames, you'd get a headache. I mean, I already get a headache when I go to, you know, like a 3D movie. Even with Avatar, at the end, I was kind of like, wow, I'm glad that the movie wasn't any longer, because it is... Definitely, it's kind of jarring to watch 3D with the kind of stuttering movement, and then also in 3D. And this effect is even worse in attractions. Last year I was in Disney World, and they have several 3D rides. You know, I remember this is one big Muppet thing where they show Muppets running around, and there was so much movement with the camera, I just got nauseous at one point. It was like I wanted to take my glasses off. Well, according to Peter Jackson, that is completely gone now that they are shooting at 48 frames per second. It's much more fluid. It's much easier on the eyes. But this is a huge revolution. Nobody has ever filmed a full-length movie, theatrical movie of this, also a blockbuster like The Hobbit is definitely going to be, at 48 frames per second, because not only are they filming at 48 frames per second, they also hope to release the movie in a lot of theaters in 48 frames per second, whereas most of the movie theaters are used to showing films in 24 frames per second. Now, according to Peter Jackson, this will be made possible because a lot of the movie theaters have already switched to digital projectors. And so it's only going to require a firmware update. So you kind of reprogram the camera to show 48 frames per second instead of 24. However, there are also a lot of theaters that still have mechanical cameras. So they show movies using old-fashioned film. And I guess that for those theaters, they will kind of down-convert the movie to 24 frames per second. But according to Peter Jackson, the real fans had better watch this in 48 frames per second, because it's going to be a totally different experience.
See, yeah, as you were talking before you mentioned, I was starting to wonder. I mean, all the sort of the kind of common criticisms of 3D movies, are they rooted in the fact that they're actually being shown at 24, filmed and shown at 24 frames per second? Could this could be the thing that actually makes people accept 3D if they watch it, if the higher frame rate makes it easier to watch? Maybe this will be the thing that puts it over the top. I mean, it's happening anyway. The movie studios know it's a good gimmick for, you know, everybody's converting things to 3D, but maybe somehow the experience of putting on those stupid glasses and watching the 3D movies will be better if it's at a higher frame rate.
Yeah, Peter Jackson talks about future proofing The Hobbit. He refers to a meeting that took place, I think, last week during some kind of convention, where a couple of high-profile filmmakers, among which George Lucas, were talking about, you know, switching to 48 frames per second, and that was a move that was inevitable, and the industry should go there. Well, if you get a few heavyweights that do that, then you need a few proof of concepts, and The Hobbit is going to be one of those movies that will just set a new standard. And then You know, there's also an industry that is going to benefit from this because, of course, it means new cameras, new projectors, new versions on DVD and Blu-ray. Let's not forget that the Blu-rays that we buy now of the Lord of the Rings, that's all going to be in 24 frames per second. So 48 frames per second, that's an interesting new market. Perhaps we need another Blu-ray format and we can, you know, sell people new machines. I don't know. I'm just speculating, but there is definitely
this is the real plot.
This is just how it works. It means new technology means that the industry will get a new impulse. Now, of course, the Lord of the Rings trilogy is filmed in 24 frames per second and you cannot generate extra frames. At least, of course, you can fake it. Like my TV, for instance, has a setting because my TV is 100 hertz. So it's a much higher refresh rate than the movie. It will actually look at the frames and calculate kind of in between frames. And so I can turn that totally off. So I get that the real, you know, 24 frames per second movie experience, and then it looks really like film. But if I turn it on and I put it on maximum, where it will generate every single missing frame, you know, instead of, you know, it will just multiply the 24 frames by four, it will create three extra frames per frame. The movement becomes really kind of weird and way too fluent, and it looks as if you're watching kind of home video. It's so strange. Like, my mind is like, this is not a movie. You're not watching film. And it almost takes me out of the experience of watching a movie. And so, and of course, this has nothing to do with the 24 frames per second per se, but it is because we've grown up with 24 frames per second. We're used to it. And so it is like, again, it's kind of very subtle subconscious signal that if you're watching a frame rate higher than 24 frames per second, it's not a movie. And according to Peter Jackson, that is probably what a lot of the film aficionados are gonna object to. And I've been watching the replies to this story on his Facebook page. I mean, this is incredible. He posts a story like that, and you know, within a day, he gets like 450 replies and more, almost 3,000 people that like that story. And in a lot of the reactions to this news, you get the same kind of, you have like two camps. One is saying, oh, this is the end of movie making, this is a fatal mistake, you know, 3D was bad, but 48 frames per second, that's going to be the end of the world. And then you've got the other camp that is like, wow, this is definitely new and revolutionary, but we'll just trust the process, you know, we'll just have to wait and see. And according to Peter Jackson, his own crew, everybody is now convinced that 48 frames per second is the way to go, even though there are a lot of kind of old movie aficionados in his own crew. And so it takes getting used to. But once you've seen a movie at 48 frames per second, according to Peter Jackson, if you go back to a kind of a regular 24 frames per second movie, you're like, wow, this looks old-fashioned. So I don't know. It's going to be my own concern, my personal concern is it's going to be so different from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So what about the continuity visually? It's a huge departure. Both the fact that they're shooting this in 3D and the fact that they're now switching to 48 frames per second. It's going to be very, very different from what we've seen in the trilogy.
Do you think it'll be as jarring as going from the original Star Wars trilogy to the prequels? Because that was when Episode One came out. That was one of the sort of common complaints that people had, or criticisms, or things that they made fun of. That somehow the technology in, you know, like when you look at like the computer screens and the ships that they were flying around in the prequel, somehow the technology appears to have gotten worse with time because the computers that they're using in the original movies are like so much worse.
Well, yeah, but that's also part. They invented a backstory to explain that, you know, at first the Republic or the Empire was very advanced, and it was on a cultural high. And then later on, when the darkness came over the universe, everything degraded, and the rebels, so like Luke Skywalker's part of the Rebel Alliance, they use kind of beaten up old equipment, and so no wonder that everything is a little bit old and beat up. So that's kind of how they explain it. And so the planet of Naboo, for instance, that is almost like the Venice of the Star Wars universe, and so everything is beautiful and smooth, and then later on everything gets bad, and it's all because of Darth Vader and the Emperor. I don't think that we're going to see that much of a problem visually, because of course the artwork, the whole design of the movie is going to be very much in continuity with what we've seen in The Lord of the Rings. So that I think was a big problem with the Star Wars prequels. It was as if production kind of went overboard in trying to make it look too great, too cool. There was something kind of gritty about the first three movies that came out. And also because they were filming a lot of things just with props and models, and it was all there on the set, whereas the prequels, it was all in front of green screen, and it lends that prequel trilogy a kind of a synthetic character, and it's a bit too jarring. It's too flashy. It's too cool looking, and I don't think that we will get that with The Hobbit. I'm just concerned that with the 48 frames per second, it's gonna look like video, and that might, but it might just be like the 3D effect in Avatar. The first 5 minutes of the movie, I was watching like, wow, that's 3D. Wow, I'm almost like cross-eyed here in the theater. And oh my gosh, I can't believe that this is, 3D. And then after a few minutes, you're like, oh, wait a minute. Oh yeah, that's true. The movie is in 3D. You kind of, you start enjoying the story and following the development of the story, and you tend to forget that you're watching something in 3D. So hopefully that will happen.
I agree. I think if it's a good movie, people enjoy it. They won't care. The film purists will complain, of course, because they'll be paying attention. But I mean, those are the same kinds of people that say that they like listening to records better than high bitrate MP3s.
And before we anger part of our audience, I totally get that there are arguments for listening to music on records. But it is very similar, indeed. There is definitely you can come up with some arguments why on is it vinyl? Or vinyl,
yeah,
vinyl. That is it's definitely a different experience from listening to a digital recording. But we're so used to CD now that if we listen to an old-fashioned record and we hear all the scratches, and we're like, wow, this is old. Can't they clean this up? And I guess that in the future, like listening to an MP3 file will be very much the same, because MP3 is also kind of very low quality audio-wise. We're so used to listening to MP3s that if you listen to a CD nowadays, or let alone like a 24 bits super high fidelity recording, it's surreal. It's so different. But if you're listening to MP3s all day long on your iPad or iPod or iPhone, you don't miss it, because you're so used to it. And I guess that with this, it's the same. If you watch a movie in 24 frames per second, you're not really missing it, except for, when there's a lot of camera movement. You might just do a test for yourself, go watch a movie, and take note, if the camera moves, for instance, it pans across a landscape, usually that will be very slow. And if they would do it faster, you'd see nothing. It's almost like if you would paint something, and then, before the paint dries, you just swipe across the paint with your hand. That's kind of what the camera does if you go too fast. And so with a lot of movement, with a lot of action, it can get very choppy. And a movie to illustrate this, and then we're going to shut up about this because this is way too technical, actually, for our show. But remember the movie Gladiator? And the final fight in the arena. Have you seen that one, Dave?
Yes.
Like the big fight with the lions and the tigers and everything.
Oh, yeah.
That final fight was very jarring. I mean, it was just you were on top of the action, and it did convey the chaos in that arena. But what they did is they actually went to even less frames per second than 24. So they deliberately kind of slowed down the shutter speed of the cameras. So it creates even more choppiness. And they use that same technique in a lot of war movies. If you watched Saving Private Ryan, for instance, there are a lot of the scenes where the soldiers are fighting. They will film sometimes at 12 frames per second. And so you get this very choppy, like, you can almost see the individual photos, the individual frames. And that, too, has a psychological impact. It just, you know, your brain is trying to fill it. It has to work really hard to fill in the blanks, as it were. And so you get much more sucked into the action. It's very, it's fatiguing, though. It's very fatiguing. Anyway, so one thing we know for sure is that watching The Hobbit is going to be a much more relaxing visual experience than the Lord of the Rings was.
Well, we hope so. Maybe we'll all find it off-putting and we won't even be able to explain why.
I don't know. Well, I'm pretty sure that there will be down-converted 24 frames per second versions of the movie as well, if only for the fact that not every theater is able to show movies in 48 frames per second. But the fact that Peter Jackson is going this route, we can be certain that this is how the industry is going to develop. Yeah, I'm not so sure about 3D, but I'm definitely thinking, you know, 48 frames per second, because there's no longer the cost factor doesn't play anymore, because we're doing things digitally now. So it's like, you know, in the past when we used to, when we had regular cameras, you know, with chemical processes, you didn't take that many pictures because it was expensive. The development of every picture was just a lot of money. Nowadays, with our digital cameras, you take like 100 pictures every minute. It's no problem. And same thing here with this revolution. It's not that much of a higher cost to go to 48 frames per second. So I guess that's why Peter Jackson is kind of, and you know, it's much easier to go back from 48 frames to 24 frames per second than the other way around. That is impossible.
Oh, yeah,
so that's I think what he means by future proofing. He's got the two big trends in this new movie: 48 frames per second plus 3D. And you can both, you know, you can get rid of both of them in case it doesn't become a trend or it doesn't establish itself as the new format. Anyway, that was quite big technical news. Let's talk about some more story-related news. We saw something about casting. Last week, we talked about Fidget. About this non-existent, nameless character played by one of the actors of the one of the two
Flight
guys
of the
from Flight of the Conchords. apparently, his role is confirmed, and he even has a name. Now, I don't find the article where that name was published. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Let's see. And I'm going to tell you in just a second. I think his name, if I recall correctly, without actually looking, I think his name is Lindir. Yes. There we go.
Lindir. Now, does that ring a bell? Is that an existing character?
No, I'm pretty sure they're making that character up.
Okay. We know that it's an elf, probably.
Now, what I'm interested to find out is whether he's going to be in Rivendell or he's going to be amongst the Wood Elves, because it's sort of ambiguous in it's kind of ambiguous in Fellowship of the Ring, because he's just kind of standing in the background during the Council of Elrond. Although I think he was standing with the Rivendell contingent, which would suggest that he's one of the high elves, he's a member of the Noldor or something, but he, they might change that. Maybe they'll make him like Legolas's best friend from back home in Mirkwood or something. So it'll be interesting to see. I wonder. Oh, actually, you know what? In the article, they say an elf of Rivendell. So there we go.
Okay,
that would seem to answer that question, assuming that the article is correct. I think he probably looks like he's going to be in Rivendell when the dwarves and Bilbo stop there during the early part of their trip.
And the fact that his character now has a name, and it's not Figwit.
He must be very excited.
It indicates that his role might be a little bit bigger than it was in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So that's good news for all his fans. It's very cool. Also, an article about, and this was kind of a joke, I think, or it was Gimli having caused Peter Jackson's ulcer. John yes. Rhys Davies, who in an interview said, you know, I at first I didn't want to be in The Hobbit, and then I had second thoughts, so I called up Peter Jackson, and you know, immediately after that he was hospitalized. So perhaps I caused his ulcer. I think he was joking.
I hope so. Otherwise, that would be sure. kind of sad.
No. That all gets lost in translation. You know, if you read like a written version of an interview like that, you don't see how you know the kind of the twinkle in the eyes and the smirk on his face. There was also a funny article about the casting of a horse. It's apparently, I mean, it's this big article in, I think it was one of the New Zealand newspapers about Claire the Mare sold to the Hobbit movie makers. It's an 11-year-old horse, was put up for sale by its owner, and then he got a call from the production department saying, hey, we'd like to use your horse for The Hobbit. And he's like, yeah, right.
Who is this?
Funny joke. but it turned out that they were actually casting horses. And they need a couple of horses for a scene where elves are riding gray horses. And because they want to, the elves, of course, being very lean and mean and slender, in order to emphasize that, they are looking for kind of stocky, bulky horses. And apparently this 11-year-old Claire totally fit that profile. It's kind of interesting. Although they said that, well, you know, when they came to get the horse, it was like, well, it's a little bit too white. So the horse is going to wear makeup during the movie. I mean, I was reading through this entire article. It was like, that was like a full-page article about one horse. And I'm pretty sure that there will be more horses than that in a movie, but wow.
It's kind of how. Why do they, like, I mean, I understand why this is news, because it's news in a local New Zealand newspaper. For all we know, that the film went around and bought up like thousands of horses. And, this is the only one anyone paid attention to.
Exactly. It's just like the story about the goat, you know?
Yeah, it's just like some local newspaper wrote it up. And if the internet being the internet, people, any article that's published on these films, people are going to find and then post and repost and share, and then it's going to become a story. But
absolutely,
it's kind of bizarre. Wow, the Hobbit film bought a horse.
Well, you know, it's just another way to keep people interested in, and if, you know, if you've got a slow news day, then the news like this gets reported, and especially the fact that it's kind of a horse that was at the end of its career as a horse, you know, and now gets this role of a lifetime being eternalized in this mega Hobbit production. It's kind of funny. They were also speculating in the article that they, you know, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, of course, we've seen a lot of horse races and scenes with horses, so they had, I don't know exactly how many horses, but lots of them. But it's possible that now, for this movie, they might need less horses, says the article, because, you know, the advances in digital technology, and you can probably just create, like, virtual horses or clone the horse. So, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see.
Oh, yeah. Maybe this is the one horse, and you're like you said, maybe they're going to use special effects to just make a bunch of horses.
Yeah,
like
Jango Fett in the Clone Wars. It's just one clone, and then you've got thousands of soldiers. All based on this one horse. We'll see. It's definitely cheaper to clone the horse digitally than to just go about and buy lots and lots of different horses. But these gray horses doesn't ring a bell. Is that part of the, you know, I guess all the elves are riding horses. So it doesn't really give us a clue, you know, which elven faction we're talking about.
Nope.
Anyway, there seems to be a kind of a, elves like gray stuff. They've got the gray havens. They've got the gray horses. I don't know. Let's move on to more important news. There was a like a discussion on the OneRing.net about film-only characters. Now, I've not read that article. Did you read through it?
I only scanned it. Mostly, it's provoked by speculation about it's speculation provoked by the casting or alleged casting of Saoirse Ronan, the girl from Lovely Bones, and now she's in that new thriller Hannah, and you know this has been going around. I mean, this her the rumors about her being in it have been going around for months, like 6 months. I mean, ever since they really started spinning this thing up, that for some reason the first thing that came up was her, just because I guess, you know, when Peter Jackson worked with her on the Lovely Bones, he basically said, all right, when I do The Hobbit, you're going to be in it, because he liked her so much. And so this rumor has persisted, and it hasn't been it still hasn't been confirmed as far as I know. It's been confirmed by her. She has said, oh, yeah, I'm definitely in it. But no one from the film has actually said, yes, she's in it, and this is the character she's playing. So it's really funny. She was one of the first people, even before they announced any of the main cast, they were talking about her being in it. Along the way, they have announced all the cast. They've confirmed people. Ian McKellen signed on and all that. And she continues to just be rumored to be in it. So it's not at all clear. But anyway, over at the OneRing.net, they just had a nice little story where they speculated about, okay, so it looks like Peter Jackson's adding characters to the movie that weren't in the book. And not only is he adding characters like Radagast the Brown and supposedly they're adding Frodo's father, Drogo, who are, you know, they are real characters that Tolkien invented. But they're not, but Peter Jackson's even just making up characters that they're adding in. So it's very interesting. You know, and it's just speculation about, like, they're adding some of these elves. There's supposedly Saoirse Ronan's character that she's rumored to play is supposed to be a love interest of some elf prince. So maybe it'd be hard to imagine she's a love interest of Legolas, but maybe not. And maybe she'll be interacting with the dwarves when they're held captive. so anyway, it's kind of a fun little article. It's just, you know, rampant speculation and it's light on facts because we don't actually have any information, but it's kind of an interesting article that the hardcore fan might enjoy reading.
Very cool. Well, we'll have to wait and see for more announcements. I'm pretty sure that they will keep some surprises for, after all, this whole production is going to take several years, and you need to keep people's interest. So I'm not surprised that they don't immediately reveal everything. Now, there was a more important article, which was an interview. The first official interview with Elijah Wood on his role in The Hobbit, and that was published on comingsoon.net. Tell me about that article.
It's just a brief interview that that Coming Soon did with him, and they just started asking him, so, you know, are you excited about being confirmed to be in the thing? What's really funny is the first thing they said was, hey, Orlando Bloom told us that he got a copy of the full script. Did you? And Elijah Wood was like, what? No, he did? I haven't gotten it yet.
Ouch.
So maybe they gave it to Orlando because they're trying to convince him it would be worth his time to be in the film.
Yes, yeah, we speculated about that last week, but yes. Wouldn't surprise me.
But he just said, and they asked him, you know, what are you excited about? And he said, oh, I'm psyched to go back to spend some more time in New Zealand and, you know, see a lot of his old friends and to be on the set and work with a lot of sort of the old art directors and casting people that were on the Lord of the Rings films. I think he's also very excited to do the 3D filming. I think he's excited to see how that goes. He was going to go, I think he was originally going to start sort of like earlier originally he was going to go later. I guess February 2012 is how I'm interpreting this. But they pushed it back a few months because he is filming this new show on I don't understand the timeline, but he's filming this new show for the FX channel.
Wilfred. Now I think he was supposed to begin filming perhaps around this time, you know, in February.
Yeah,
but since the movie was pushed back.
That's how I'm interpreting it now.
Now he's coming back to shoot at the end of this year, so 2011, yeah, around December or November.
Yes.
Which is springtime in New Zealand, because we're heading into, well, currently it's autumn, and we're heading into winter time. So it's not surprising that most of the filming that is being done now is done on sound stages instead of outside.
Yep.
The fact that he comes back in December or November when it's springtime, it might be an indication, but again, this is speculation, that his scenes might be also outside, you know, on the set of the Shire, perhaps, in Matamata, because then it will be, you know, the flowers will be in full bloom, and it will have that typical kind of springtime Shire weather that we are used to. So it could, story-wise, could be an indication that he will be reading from the Red Book to, I don't know, the hobbits of the Shire.
Yep.
You know, so this would be before his departure.
That seems reasonable to me, and I do know I happen to know for a fact that he's very busy filming for Wilfred, because I know people who are involved in that production, actually.
Oh, cool. So, what is that? What kind of series is that?
It's going to be it's going to be sort of a bizarre, surrealist half hour comedy. I think it's a half hour. It's based on an Australian show called Wilfred. And basically what it is that Elijah Wood's going to play this sort of, lonely, kind of depressed, possibly crazy guy who his next door neighbor is this beautiful woman that he's in love with. And, one day she comes over and says, can you watch my dog, Wilfred? Is it all right if he stays in your yard while I go run an errand? And Elijah's like, oh, yeah, sure, why not? And it turns out, for some reason, Elijah, when he looks at this dog, sees a guy in a dog suit. Everyone else thinks it's a dog, sees it as a dog, treats it like a dog. Elijah, for some reason, sees it as this Australian comedian in a dog suit. And so it's kind of a crazy buddy comedy between him and the guy in the dog suit, except the guy in the dog suit is
a real dog.
Yeah, he seems to be a real dog because he behaves like a dog. He runs after people who go by on bikes, and he digs holes in the yard and does dog things. But then he also sits and has conversations with this guy.
It's almost the opposite of Calvin and Hobbes, you know?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Oh,
you
man.
Can find, you can actually watch a lot of clips of the old Australian one on YouTube if you look.
Oh,
up
it's an
Wilfred.
Existing series. It's a remake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
Yep. So, I'm. This is probably just wishful thinking, but I'm trying to convince some of the people that I know to put me in touch with Elijah. I'm going to try to get him on our show. I'm sure it won't happen, but and they're like,
hey, we can
stop
always dream.
Asking us. We can't do that.
Exactly. Brilliant. And of course, I'll come over to California in case you ever happen to land that interview. I want to be there.
We will fly you out for it.
Well, in the meantime, we'll have to do with the information that we get from New Zealand and all the little glimpses. And, we now have to get to the main, the biggest news of the week, which was this amazing video posted on Facebook of the set. At first, when I saw the first message about this, I thought this was going to be a one-minute thing. Instead, it is more than 10 minutes long, and it's a fantastic tour of the set of Bag End. We get to see a lot of the different production departments where they are working on the costumes and the hairdos and whatnot. We see fighting. We see lots and lots of things. Let's listen to a few fragments, and then we'll just pause after every fragment and talk about what we've seen. The first one is the beginning of the video. Let's see.
Hello, welcome to the first of our blogs on the making of The Hobbit. It's amazing to be back here again. This is Bag End, exactly as it was in The Lord of the Rings. And it's actually built in our B stage here in Wellington, and which is exactly the same stage as it was built 12 years ago. We've been shooting for a few days now, and I just wanted to take this opportunity to give you a little look at the lead up to filming and some of the pre-production that led up to the first day of our shoot. And I look forward to keeping you up to date as we go through the next 2 or 3 years.
Now, Dave, you've just watched this video. What were your first impressions?
Oh, I'm just giddiness. I mean, you know me, Father.
Yeah, I know.
I'm highly critical of the old Lord of the Rings films. All the little changes annoy me, and and I, you know, sometimes say mean things about Peter Jackson. But just watching this, I just had two responses. One, just giddy, because it's giving us a taste, a feel for things, and seeing like all the actors playing dwarves gathered in Bilbo's room is just gives you a little thrill. But also, just gratitude to Peter Jackson. What a wonderful thing for him to be doing, to share this with us, not just to churn out a movie and sell it to us, but to involve us in the process of making it. I mean, that's so cool.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
I totally agree. It his tone is very very much as if he made this little video clip just for you. You know, that's what I love about his, and he's always been like that. Engaging the audience and treating the fans with respect, and almost as if we are part of kind of his entourage, and he takes us along for the ride. And it's something that he conveys in his audio commentaries on every DVD that I've watched so far. It's almost as if you're sitting with him in the same room watching that movie. That's kind of his tone. He doesn't have this behavior of like, oh, I'm this very famous filmmaker, and you should bow down and listen to me in silence and prayer. Not at all. So I totally love the style of this first blog entry. I like the fact that he calls it a blog. It's totally a non-pretentious, whereas this was very well produced. I mean, it looked awesome. It was clearly they put a lot of work in the editing and the sound of this little behind the scenes sequence, and we get to see some super cool stuff. Listen to this second fragment here of the video.
So we're going up to wardrobe, and we're having a look at a couple of dwarf wardrobe and makeup fittings, which is always exciting. Not that we'll show you much in this particular vlog, because we'll save that for the future, but at least you'll get to see a little bit of our wardrobe department.
Now, this was where I just sat and started to press pause every second, because I didn't want to miss anything. Now, they blurred out a few of the designs, a few of the drawings on the walls, is because otherwise, you know, in the HD version, you might be able to see a little bit too much. They might want to kind of show you bit by bit. They might do a whole segment about the dwarves later on. So we get to see some glimpses, and there are some fragments, like 2 seconds of this, 2 seconds of that. If you go through the video clip frame by frame, there's actually a lot that you can see. I took some notes. First thing I want to mention is you see the actual camera rig. So we've seen the monitors on that picture that he posted, but now we see the actual rig. 2 red cameras. There's only one mounted on that rig for now. You've got the 2 tiny monitors on which they can see what every camera is filming. The actual red camera is very small. It's just this little box that is hooked up to the monitor. And then on the other side, if you look closely, you see this huge lens. So the lens is like twice as big as the actual camera. This is very exciting. These red cameras are not even out. You can't even buy them. So this is almost like a world premiere, I think, of these particular red cameras. Very cool. What mm-hmm. struck me was that the actual rig is still very big. And it's mostly due to the fact that it carries not only the red camera, but also the lenses, and then all this monitoring equipment, the little video monitors that they use. Definitely not a portable thing. So I wonder what they will do with the Steadicam shots. Steadicam was used extensively in The Lord of the Rings, and it's basically the cameraman is carrying around the camera with counterweights and everything, so you get very fluent movements. You see this also in a lot of reality shows and with American Idol. A lot of the scenes that you see on stage are filmed with Steadicams. You can be very dynamic, but it's very heavy. Because not only do you have to carry the camera itself, the lenses, and it's all glass, so, you know, imagine the weight, plus the counterweight, so to make sure that you can move the camera, you know, the weight is not just in the camera, but it's kind of counterbalanced. So you're carrying at least twice the weight, 3 times, 4 times the weight of the camera itself. Multiply that by 2, I think that they need some trolls, actually, to carry around this camera equipment or some, I don't know. I wonder what they're going to do. So that was very cool to get a glimpse of those cameras. Then,
or some Olifants.
Yeah, who knows, yes. But then you lose the dynamic movement. And you might get some unwanted sounds of, stressed Olifants. We also saw two set chairs very quickly, one with the name Gollum on it, and then a very small one with the name Bilbo on it. My first reaction was like, why? Yeah, Bilbo is a hobbit, so yes, the chair is very small. So I thought it was a joke. And then later on, you see a scene with the actors, and this is part of the ceremony almost of the first day of filming, where they have these indigenous people from New Zealand performing a dance and then an actual kind of a tribal blessing of the studios. And then at one point, you see all the actors that are there right now shaking hands with, I don't know, I guess the people that performed the dance. And there's this tiny little man walking in between the full-size actors. And so I was like, wow, they do use, they're not using a child this time, but it's an older actor, but he's very, very small. And so that's probably his chair. So I guess that we've seen the first glimpse of the actor that is going to portray Bilbo, in the scenes where he has to interact with elves and humans. So that was a tiny detail, but I thought it was very interesting. We also get some glimpses of all the gear. We see a scene with the beards, the dwarf beards. So they've got these white plastic heads, and then the beards are actually being made right there in that scene. It goes by very quickly, but if you kind of go by it frame by frame, you see a few ladies working on beards. And what struck me was that all the beards are very different in style. They look really cool, very, very cool. Much more sophisticated almost as the beards that we've seen on dwarves in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Different colors, you've got, gray hair, black, brown, or almost orange hair. There was also a wig, and again, this is just in one or two frames. It's on the top shelf, and it looks exactly like Frodo's hair in the trilogy. So it doesn't look like dwarven hair, it definitely looks like hobbit hair. Perhaps that might be Frodo's wig. We see some hobbit feet. That was pretty cool. It looked pretty realistic. We get a demonstration of one of the weapons, a bow. And then also there's a knife or a dagger on the table itself. So that was very cool. And they show the costumes of the dwarves. Again, this goes by very quickly. But if you pause it, you see that on every... there are these, it's kind of store. It's a storage space with lots and lots of clothes. And then you've got all the names of all the dwarfs there with the names of the actors underneath. And in one frame, you see that there is something that looks like a fat suit. And we talked about this, we speculated about this, that the dwarfs, the actors, most of the actors that play the dwarfs are not very heavy. So they, in order to come across as real dwarfs, they probably need some more volume, and fat suits is usually what they use. And later on in the video, they actually they joke about that when the dwarves are together with Bilbo and Gandalf at Bag End. They are talking about the dwarves having to carry these fat suits, which of course is very uncomfortable. It's heavy, and most annoying aspect of it is it is warm. It's all, like synthetic material. So if you walk around in a fat suit, and then on top of that clothes, and then the studio lights on it, or when they film outside in summertime, it's going to be excruciating. And so Peter Jackson at one point tells McKellen, at least you don't have to carry a fat suit. No, he says, I just get to wear the huge hat and the fake nose and the fake beard and the fake eyebrows and then this very thick cloth, this robe that I have to wear. And they joke about kind of the the downside of having to play these exotic characters with all these layers of clothing. From what I could tell, a lot of the dwarven clothes are kind of what we've seen also in the Lord of the Rings, different colors, but nothing too outrageous. It's definitely not Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, fortunately. It's kind of more muted colors. Let's see what else. There is a scene where we see the artist, the conceptual artist, and among them, and they are very shy. They just, you know, Peter Jackson is like totally like my mom used to do when she was filming us. It's like, wave at the camera, say hi, smile now. And Peter Jackson does the same with these artists, and they're like, oh, hi there. And they scurry away. But among those artists, I didn't recognize all of them, but I definitely recognized the two big names that we know from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, Alan Lee and John Howe. These two were amazing in kind of shaping the whole look of the trilogy, and the fact that they are involved also in The Hobbit instills a lot of confidence. I mean, I love the work of these guys. I think that they are largely responsible for the success of the look of the visual look of the Lord of the Rings. The fact that they are involved in The Hobbit, I cannot wait to see what they will come up with. But it's going to be awesome.
I'm excited.
It's brilliant. The sword fighting, you see them training, and it's a very elaborate fight. It looks very dynamic.
That's a very elaborate sight. Very elaborate fight. It's the choreography is pretty good. I don't know who was that was sort of at the center swinging the sword and killing everyone else.
I think at first it was just one of the dwarves, probably one of the actors mm-hmm. that portrays the dwarves, and then you get a close up of, I think, the trainer. So the guy who's actually doing the fighting, I think he's the New Zealand martial arts expert, but I might be mistaken. You also see some horse riding. At least you see the actors getting some training, and those are definitely the dwarves that are riding those horses. So that was pretty cool. We see a kind of a weird animatronic. And at first I was like, is this Gollum? And I said, no, it doesn't look like Gollum. It's probably an orc or something like that. And you see also a very brief sequence in which they do motion capture for this animatronic. And I wonder, you see the guy who's performing the motion capture, he's in a gray suit. I think it's Circus, but I'm not certain. It could be someone else. But I wouldn't be surprised if Circus, instead of, you know, in addition to doing Gollum, is also going to provide a lot of the movement for the, you know, the orcs and perhaps even the dragon. Who knows? He did the same in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. This guy is just so versatile unstoppable. So that was cool to see that. So motion capture not only used for CGI characters, but also for actual animatronics. Then we see a stunt, again, very briefly. Seems to be, again, a motion capture scene for the... And I think this is part of the scene on the river with the barrels, because the guy who the stunt guy who is on you know, is being swung in the air with lots of ropes. He's on something that looks like a barrel, at least has the shape of a barrel, and he's thrown off rather violently. So I wouldn't be surprised if this is going to be part of the river scene. That this is part of the stunts on the barrel. But I'm not sure. In the chat room, I read that people are like, what, dwarves riding horses? That can't be correct. They have to ride on ponies. So, yeah, that's mm-hmm. That's a good point. I don't know. I'm not sure. Perhaps these dwarves are just really, really good with horses. But then again, you get the size problem. I don't know. If you put the real actors on ponies, it's not going to match. It's not going to be... I don't know. Well, we'll wait and see. The other thing that we see is the wardrobe department. You see Gandalf's hat also. That was pretty cool. Very recognizable. And then you get this strange kind of demonstration of sword fighting by this dwarf and with gray hair filmed from the back. You don't see his face, but it looks really cool. That's the part where they blurred out almost half of the scene. Because they want to show us later on. Let's see, I've got another...
You don't want to give away too much.
Exactly. Then we get to see this amazing other sequence. When the video clip shows this, I was like, oh, my jaw dropped to the ground.
Now, this is a familiar set. It's Elrond's chambers, and it's an exact copy of the one that we had in the Fellowship of the Ring. In fact, just over here on the balcony is where the Council of Elrond took place, where the Fellowship was formed and Frodo volunteered to take the ring to Mordor. But also in The Hobbit, there's going to be a lot of new bits of Rivendell that we haven't seen before. Some really cool bits of Rivendell, actually, that will keep us a little surprise for the time being.
That was so awesome to see Elrond's house and just the size of that set, and it was beautifully lit and everything. I mean, I wish I was there just to walk around there. And I think even Peter Jackson was a little bit impressed. He was walking around there. It's like, this is like walking in a movie. So strange. Oh, it was totally awe-inspiring.
Isn't that interesting what he said, that it's weird to be back in the set, you know, like after having basically what he was saying was he got used to seeing that set and that scenery on the screen in a movie, sort of the way the rest of us did. And then he's, you know, being back in it actually in the physical set, he said it's weird. He says it feels like he's stepping into a movie. I just thought that was interesting because, I mean, this is a guy who was in the set before, and even he sort of gets that whole, wow, I'm stepping into a movie feeling.
Well, let's not forget, it's years and years and years ago. And,
that's right. Good point.
he's made a lot of other movies in between, so it must be really almost like a deja vu walking onto that set, and especially because the Rivendell set is so gorgeous. It's so beautiful. I mean, it's life size. There's not much fake. Everything is, you know, handcrafted. There's an incredible sense of detail. And he walks up the stairs, and then you get to the set with the broken sword. I thought it was pretty amazing as well. Of course, that is also part of what we will see in The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of hinting at some other parts of Rivendell that we might see. Do you have any idea what that could be? I was like racking my brain. What else is in the story that we don't see yet? What could be in there as a surprise?
I don't know. You know, we don't see a lot of Rivendell in The Hobbit. There's sort of the what will be interesting is, what I want to see is how they will do sort of the dwarves' initial approach to Rivendell, where they're kind of walking through, you know, down a road through some woods, and there's elves that are sort of just out of sight singing songs and teasing them and making fun of them and doing and singing goofy things. It'll be interesting to see how they handled that, because I wonder how that's sort of a stark contrast with the sort of very serene, dignified elves that they portray.
I think there could be a lot of film. There could be a lot of humor in the kind of the contrast between, you know, those rather bulky, not very civilized dwarves, at least from mm-hmm. the perspective of the elves, and then the sophisticated elves. It's going to be fun.
And as you recall, they. In The Hobbit, they mostly refer to the last homely house, you know, which mm-hmm. is sort of like one. I mean, the way I interpret it, and the way they execute it in Lord of the Rings Online is like one building mm-hmm. in Rivendell, and they don't really talk much about Rivendell as a whole. So I think they're going to have to improvise a lot on that.
Yeah, they will probably just fill it in a little bit, but. Can't wait to see more of Rivendell. I think it was one of the most beautiful sets in the Lord of the Rings, especially because the rest of the movie is all taking place in almost everything is outside, and it's lots of orcs, and you know, just being in that elven environment is just such a visually just such a feast. It's so beautiful, and then just getting that glimpse, that extensive kind of. A tour of those Rivendell sets. That alone, you know, if he had just posted that, I would have watched that 10 times. So awesome, 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 awesome. Then we get this.
We have a dwarf locked off. This is where we're going to be shooting. at the very beginning of our shoot. It's the goblin tunnels below the Misty Mountains. It's a very iconic scene in The Hobbit where Bilbo has an encounter with, well, you know who it's with, don't you, if you read The Hobbit? No need to spoil it for anybody that hasn't.
I wonder if anyone that is watching this video has not read The Hobbit. I can't imagine.
I hope
that.
Not.
And even if they haven't, I mean, this is kind of the...
Surely they, at least, even if they haven't actually read it, surely just popular culture has penetrated their skull.
Right, exactly.
They must be at least aware.
But it looks... Well, it looked like an underground set. Nothing too fancy or special. It's just going to be gloomy, and it's going to be an interesting scene. But I thought that the final part. Well, I'm not talking about that whole ceremony, which was interesting to see as well, because it shows a lot of kind of the local New Zealand culture with the dance and the blessing of the set and everything, and seeing just all the actors present there for the first time and embarking on this huge adventure. But what I really enjoyed watching was what Peter Jackson calls the blocking of a scene in the in Bilbo's house. And we get to see this.
We have a dwarf locked off.
This is where we're going to be
shooting. Wait, I just played that one. We get to see this.
So how many chairs do we need? For instance, should we... I reckon Bomber sits at the end. And then there's a slight grapple, and then when you pop down, it's like... Yeah. And then it's like...
That's the cue. Yeah. Okay. Now I know it's sort of safe. Yeah, I can interrupt.
This is blocking. This is sort of not really rehearsing, but we're kind of getting... The actors are walking through, and we're sort of talking about what to do with the scene. And it's actually fun, because it means when we come to shoot this... We've got a plan. It'd be good if you come forward and then you realise there's something on your foot, and perhaps you try to get rid of it first, you know. And you kind of, this will be fun. This will be more fun when everybody's in makeup and costumes and dying of the heat. Sort of on the corner of the table, we've got Killy.
Awesome.
Next to Killy, Philly, and then Dory, and then Nori. Oh my God. Ori, Dori, Nori, Biffa, Bomba, Biffa, Biffa, Loin, Oin, Nori, Dori, Nori. This is a nightmare.
I love that little segment where they show this guy. Wait. They are actually trying to figure out how to film this. And what struck me was how relaxed the atmosphere is. And apparently they're just kind of improvising a lot of stuff. They have the overall script, of course, but... with the actors, and he involves the actors in, you know, how are we going to portray this? And I think that is the mark of a great director, someone who involves the his own actors in trying to figure out how to make this scene work. I think that's one of the big qualities of Peter Jackson. And of course, it has a risk for the purists that they might come up with stuff that is not in a book or that is different from the way that J.R.R. Tolkien describes it. But then again, Dave, you wouldn't have anything to gripe about if they didn't do that. So,
well, that's true, and you know that's one of the things that I get most pleasure from in life.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
I wouldn't want him to take that away from me. Plus, a lot of that's more. I really deep down don't feel completely that way anymore. I not only understand that they have to change things in the film, but I also understand that he's telling a different story. So I'm willing to give him the space to sort of see what he can do. And I'm excited still. I'm excited.
It was very cool to see all the actors there together with McKellen and Bilbo is there, and just seeing them, you know, talk to each other and having fun. And the overall vibe that I get is that this is going to work. There is chemistry among this crew, even though they've not yet really worked that much together, but you can tell that everybody is into it, everybody's excited, and there's this general vibe of like, we're really doing this. It's we are embarking on a 3-year adventure, and we're gonna have a lot of fun. And I think that chemistry is what made The Lord of the Rings so good. It was that everybody, even though it must have been an excruciating enterprise, but at the same time, it was so rewarding, and there was such a friendship at the end between the actors. And that is, I think, the the core message, I think, that Tolkien even wanted to convey is that, you know, the story of these hobbits, story of the ring, it is ultimately a story about friendship and about how far friendship can bring you and what it can accomplish and how it can literally improve the world and change the world, change Middle Earth. And in a way, the whole process of filming is almost like a second story, like a parallel story to the story that they are depicting. And you've got the same, you got this, you're fighting like the technical problems, you're fighting the stress, the heat. It is definitely, it's a battle on its own. And it, at the same time, it forges friendship. And there are these moments of tension and disagreement. And we remember this whole problem with, what's his name? The other wizard.
Oh, Saruman.
Saruman, the actor who played Saruman, who was mad at Peter Jackson that he was cut out of the, you know, theatrical release of the third movie. And then, you know, you get these things and then they reconcile, they find each other again. It's a wonderful human story.
It's like a family.
Yeah, in a way, you could write a book about that and it would be worth reading. So I think that thanks to these video podcasts, or these video blogs, we might be able to follow that story as well. And I think they're off to a very, very good start. And after having seen this, I'm just like all the thousands of other people that have commented on this video already on the Facebook page. I was like, I am so giddy. I'm so excited about this movie. I can't wait.
Yeah, me too.
Can't wait to see it.
Like I said, you watch it and you get a little thrill.
Absolutely. Hey, it's really time. This has been a long show, but there was just so much news. We need to wrap things up. But before we close the show, as usual, I want to talk about the tip of the week. And Dave, you have an important tip.
Yeah, I think it's a big one. So we've mentioned a few times this thing called Dúnedain Radio, and that there's sort of this group of people that are kind of trying to build up a really tight-knit Tolkien online community. And they're launching this thing called Middle Earth Network, which ties together Dúnedain Radio and some other things. But they also just launched the beta of a Middle Earth-themed social network. It's called... what is it called? I think it's called My Middle Earth, and it's at the Middle Earth Network. So if you navigate your browser over to mymiddle-earth.com, you can sign up for it. It's really cool. It's very fun. You can listen to the Dúnedain Radio directly from it while you're playing around on there. And you can also listen to music from John D. Bartolo's band, the Lonely Mountain Band. You can make groups on there. So I've already set up groups for our podcasts, Secrets of the Hobbit and Secrets of Middle Earth. You can go and meet other Tolkien fans. Apparently, overnight, a whole bunch of people from China joined My Middle Earth.
Cool.
There's some group of Tolkien fans from there found out about this and joined up, and so it's actually growing really fast. So definitely go over there. I think this is going to sort of become the center hub of Tolkien fans.
Very, very cool. And so that's also where you can listen to Dúnedain Radio. There was another announcement, or at least you have a little bit of a teaser, isn't it?
Yes. So Dúnedain Radio and Middle Earth Network are going to, let's see, on Tuesday, April 19th at, I think, 10:30 a.m. I think that's actually my time. I think it's around 2:30 p.m. Eastern time. But check the website. They're going to have a special announcement from the Tolkien professor related to some Hobbit news. That's all I can say at this point. But if you're not at work, or even if you're at work and you can get away with it, go over there at, I think, 2:30 p.m. on Tuesday or listen to the Dúnedain Radio at that time. And you can listen to this announcement live. It's going to be very exciting.
Very cool. I'm super curious. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter. The Twitter account is SQPN Hobbit. And you can also follow SQPN Tolkien. Both feeds are dedicated to our shows about Middle-earth and about The Hobbit. We also have a website that you can visit, thehobbit.sqpn.com. Thehobbit.sqpn.com. That's also where you can find our Facebook fan page, where we post news throughout the week. Thank you for listening. If you have some time, hop over to iTunes and post a review or rate this podcast. It will help other people find this show. We want to thank you for listening. If you have any feedback, you can send it to tolkien@sqpn.com. And, well, hopefully we will see you again next week on The Secrets of the Hobbit.
SQPN, leading the way in Catholic new media.